Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Hello, everyone. I'm Kimberly Adams. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
And I'm Nova Safo. It's Tuesday, April 23rd. Today, we're diving into a single topic, and that's dollar stores. Some are thriving, others struggling. And you want to know why. What's happening with the dollar store business model?
That's right. We're talking 99-cent stores, Dollar Tree, Family Dollar. Lots of these companies have announced closures in recent weeks, but that's not the case for competitor Dollar General. And I know all these names are confusing because they're confusing to me, but that chain, Dollar General, is planning a big expansion. So what's going on here? Here to make us smart on the economics behind dollar stores and why it matters is Sandro Steinbach, professor of agribusiness and applied economics at North Dakota State University. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So first of all, can you give us a sense of the size of this industry? How many dollar-ish stores there are and like what chunk of the economy they take up?
Sure. Dollar stores, right, which involve Family Dollar, Dollar Tree, General Dollar, 99 cent stores, and a few others that you might have heard or visited in the past are a growing part of the U.S. retail industry. When it comes to dollar store, there are about $20,000 General and about $16,700 Tree and Family Dollar actually across the United States. And that industry has experienced some very significant growth over the years, but expanding with annual growth rates above 10%.
Is it true that they make up a greater number than Starbucks and McDonald's?
Yeah, particularly in rural and in suburban America, they have become a major part of daily life, actually, occupying a major niche also when it comes to access to food.
Yeah, and a lot of these food deserts. Now, dollar stores generally have this reputation for being resilient in both good and bad economic times. Has that been the case in recent years?
Yeah, dollar stores, right, they operate actually on pretty low profit margins. I mean, if you think about the average profit margin over the last couple of years, a drop from about 10% to about 5%. Particular Dollar Tree, right, which had been experiencing some significant announcements to shutter existing businesses, you know, dropping the number of Family Dollars by about 1,000 and also announcing further reductions in Dollar Tree stores by about 400 in the coming years, has seen profit margin or net profit margin actually falling to 4%. And last year in particular, they were pretty low at about minus 3%. That's fairly low compared to many of the other industries, actually. And that business had been very, very successful over the years. But if you look, for instance, and compare Dollar Tree profits with those of Dollar General, Dollar Tree had about $3 billion in profits last year, while Dollar General had about $11 billion. What is interesting here is that Dollar Tree in particular faced some very significant capital expenditures, which are largely due to their acquisition of Family Dollar in 2015, which costed the company about $8 billion and was part of that growth strategy, actually to capture a large share of the existing U.S. market and come in as a disruptive force while the market basically consolidates. And that's where we are right now in terms of this market. Well, in contrast, Dollar General has very similar net profit margins such as Dollar Tree, while at the same time still hasn't, you know, has still continues with its expansion plans, actually. And that is largely driven by the different profitability of those businesses.
But why is that? What's the difference between the two?
Sure. One big factor that played in, right, was the acquisition of Family Dollar in 2015. If you think about Family Dollar and Dollar Tree and what is their difference, Dollar Tree is mostly suburban and it caters to middle income shoppers with, you know, party supplies and little things, basically. In contrast, Family Dollar sells more basic foods and household essentials. So basically catering to low income consumers in urban and rural areas. If you think about Dollar General, it has a very strong rural base. And that's a real advantage of Dollar General, actually, because it's a catchment zone, right, that any of these businesses need to be operational and be profitable, actually. It's much smaller than if you think about an independent grocery retailer in that sense. So that had been also one of the big issues that Dollar Tree actually faced over the last years was the cannibalization of business activities across many Family Dollar locations. And so it was a fairly rational decision, actually, for the Dollar Tree leadership to decide to actually cut some of the businesses and reduce the cannibalization across locations.
So this is a very low margin business, you know, approaching the low margin levels of airlines, which is very low. How do they manage to keep their, costs down? I understand that they've been dollar store chains have been criticized for their labor practices, for potentially, you know, maybe exploitative behavior in terms of how they target customers. Can you explain the business model itself?
Yeah, and that's fairly interesting. But if you think about the typical dollar store, it's staffed by a store manager. It has 1 to 3 assistant store managers and then 3 to a couple of more sales associates, actually. And that's much less than the typical small independent grocery store, which employs, you know, significantly more people, about 14 people on average. And that obviously means that they can keep costs significantly lower. In addition, Dollar Store, right, benefits significant by keeping wholesale cost under control. They buy in bulk, and that's a significant price advantage compared to many of the independent grocery retailers that particularly operate in rural areas. And many of you likely have heard the term shrinkflation, and that's also a factor that actually is allowing dollar stores to keep some of the rising prices that we see due to inflation and other factors and playing against such as supply chain disruptions under control and avoiding to alienate customers. In that sense, right, if we think about inflation, these businesses tend to cut the sizes instead of cutting price. And that's why it is $1, $3, $4, $5 business works out fairly well, actually.
You know, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but many communities really depend on these dollar stores for access to food and other necessities. Where are these closures happening and how are those communities going to be affected?
Yeah, there had been some pre-release data that I was able to have a look at, and there are many suburban, but also a lot of rural areas where those shops are actually closing. And that's a concern because in rural America, lower income residents, right, depend on access to affordable food. And local department stores, such as here up in North Dakota, they tend to be 50 miles, 75 miles away. And therefore, the pop-up dollar stores that had been appearing over the last 20 years actually filled an important niche, right? They cater to low-income consumers in many ways, which obviously prefer lower prices that dollar stores can actually offer while they are in close proximity. So what shouldn't be underestimated here is actually the convenience of access to dollar stores.
So benefits exist for these stores being in neighborhoods that are underserved. And yet we've seen communities try to block them from coming in, try to block dollar stores from coming in. Why is that? Why have some voted to do so?
So in general, they're interesting to have dollar stores coming to the community. It's just that the bunching of those stores, right? When you have dollar stores every couple of miles, basically, that's their main concern, basically, because you have these adverse impacts on independent grocery stores and access to food in general. My colleagues, Kenan Marchese from the USDA Economic Research Service and Rigoberto Lopez, who is with the University of Connecticut, recently conducted a study where we analyzed store-level data on dollar stores at independent grocery stores across the United States from 2000 to 2020 to look into what are the implications of when dollar store actually comes to town. And we found some very striking results. We found that business closures of independent grocery stores increased by about 2.3%. At the same time, we also see that their employment and sales go down. So there are quite some marked impacts actually on dollar store entry. At the same time, there is some significant variation actually, particularly in rural communities. Once a dollar store enters that market, the probability of a independent grocery retailer actually exiting, which tend to be providing, you know, more healthy food and also employing a lot more people, is going up 3 times more than in an urban area actually.
You know, it reminds me of the pushback earlier when Walmart started coming into a lot of communities.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. It has a similar tinges to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but we are not in the beginning, right? I mean, dollar stores have been expanding significantly over the last 20 years. So we talk about 50,000 stores. So it's the end of the wave already, right? It's almost an industry that is maturing, actually. And that's what we see these days, right? It's a maturing industry that want to keep costs in check to get profits basically up. And that's why we have these this closure of family dollar stores and 99-cent stores.
All right. Well, you know, that kind of anticipated my last question, that this era of the proliferation of dollar stores, it's coming to an end then. There is a kind of a shift happening.
I think there's potential for more consolidation actually coming up, right? It's a low margin business, and low margin business operate in two ways, right? You grow or you die. And so the attitude that Dollar General has, right? We expand more, we add more stores basically, and we can always cut back as long as the equity is there to do that actually. Their liabilities are comparably low actually, and while they are still making profits in that sense. So the approach that many of those companies are taking is a disruptive entry where you get into a market, you try to occupy as large as possible of a market niche. And then it comes the day, right, when you basically outcompete your competitors. And that's maybe something that we are going to see in that market, which is still very much localized, right, where Dollar General and Dollar Tree and Family Dollar really have really localized markets and compete very little with each other, but they compete a lot with independent grocery retailers.
All right, we'll leave it there today. Professor Sandro Steinbach, to pronounce it in as close to the authentic Austrian as I can, joining us from Fargo, Professor of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University. Thank you very much for this.
Yes, thank you, Professor.
Thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
Likewise. When was the last time you were in a dollar store, Nova?
I don't think I ever have been.
Really?
How about you? Yeah.
Probably a couple months ago, I was indeed buying some party supplies.
Party supplies.
Yeah. I mean, just as the professor was saying, like a lot of, you know, depending on where you are and, you know, especially what sort of like economic band you're in, you're using these stores very differently. But I also remember a couple years ago, I went on a trip to West Virginia with a girlfriend of mine. And, you know, we needed to get some groceries for this place we were staying. And the only place to get groceries was the Dollar Tree, and they weren't so much groceries as just, you know, packaged foods and things like that. But that was the only option for quite some distance.
You know, I mean, I've had situations where the only option has been like, you know, the Walmart superstore nearby. You know, when especially as you said, when you're visiting places, but it's never. I've never had that particular limitation. So I think it really seems to be very neighborhood and region specific, it seems.
Mm. Well, we want to know what you think. Do you shop at dollar stores? Do you have a favorite dollar store chain? You can tell us about it at 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART. And we will be right back.
Okay, time for some news. Kimberly, why don't you get us going?
Yes, I've been getting a bunch of emails from Mozilla over the past like week or so about this report they put out. They're often sort of scanning apps and different websites for the privacy protections on the apps or the lack thereof. But they recently did a deep dive on dating, deep dive, because it's Tuesday, deep dive on dating apps. And it is not ideal from a privacy perspective. Researchers at the, I'm reading here from the Washington Post summary, researchers at Mozilla Foundation's Privacy Not Included project updated reviews of the 25 most popular dating apps out there based on their user privacy practices, data breach track records, and more. The result, 22 of those apps, including popular options like Tinder, Grindr, OkCupid, Hinge, and Bumble, received the team's privacy not included warning label. Among other things, Mozilla's researchers found that 80% of the apps they reviewed may share or sell your personal information for advertising. Oh, and there's some examples. Yeah, there's one particularly strange example. If you're a coffee meets bagel user looking to break the ice with a match before meeting up in person, you could use the app's video chat feature. That is, if you're okay with the company collecting, quote, the content and information you make available using our video chat feature.
Are you kidding?
And, you know, a lot of these companies say that they may collect that information, but especially, you know, with so many companies selling the data that they do have for AI to train these AI models and things like that, or even using AI in their models and having these chat bots and all these different things, it's just useful to remind yourself that when the product is free, you are the product. And sometimes also when you pay for a product, you are still the product. And just check those privacy settings and be mindful of what you're putting on there, and watch out. So
this is cringy because, I mean, people put a lot of information about themselves on dating apps because that's the point.
Yeah, you know, and you're trying to filter, right?
Yeah.
And so
this is really cringy.
Well, but what's also worth noting is that sometimes it's not just the information that's on your profile that can be used by these apps. It's also the information in your chat exchanges. And a lot of this is tied to safety features. They want to be able to go back, and if someone has done something, you know, weird or scary, to be able to access that conversation or to flag conversations for scams or for potential violence or whatever. And so there are definitely safety arguments for these companies having, you know, some kind of access to this stuff. But, you know, just these are companies designed to make a profit.
Yeah. Access one thing, but collecting the data and then using it for commercial purposes, yeah, is something else. So that's, I don't know.
All right, what you got?
What do you do? I guess we could all just go back to coffee shops and bars and meeting people at grocery stores.
Well, Christian Schwab, so our colleague, has done quite a bit of reporting about sort of this backlash to online dating and dating apps and the return to IRL meeting people. And I, you know, from my very small sample size of people, single people I know, a lot of folks are becoming very disenchanted with the apps and just, you know, trying different things.
I think I support that wholeheartedly. I think it's cannot beat IRL as the language. All right. Okay, my story broke this morning. The Department of Justice announced that it had reached a settlement with dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of young women, to pay them $139 million to resolve claims over their mishandling of the investigation into Larry Nassar, who was the women's gymnastics organizations,
coach, yeah.
Not coach. He was their main doctor. Their lead doctor. And using that power and position, he abused hundreds of young girls and young women who, from the early 90s is the earliest evidence, to all the way to 2016. And the FBI was informed finally. The U.S. Olympic Committee or the gymnastics, I think, one of the organizations actually submitted a report to the police, and the FBI did a very shoddy, basic, quick investigation, and then kind of it sat without anything being done for 8 months. And in that period of time, there's evidence that dozens and dozens of more young women and girls were abused. So that's where the settlement comes in. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, has publicly apologized to those young girls and women. And this information that I'm sharing is not new information. There have been, in the Inspector General report, the FBI's Inspector General has conducted a report and released it publicly. There's been a major law firm did also a kind of an independent investigation for the U.S. Olympic Committee as well. So there were multiple failures in the case of Larry Nassar, and multiple failures for decades, where these organizations from the university where he worked in Michigan, Michigan State University, to the Olympics, United States Olympics Committee, to the gymnastics organization, failed these girls and young women, and did not believe them, did not seriously take these allegations when they came up, or did not question strange behaviors by this predator. And this is one
and
of the last
chapters. And sometimes actively protected him.
And actively protected, in fact, especially the university and the, and yes, absolutely, you're right, and the gymnastics committee. So I had to, this really hits close. I mean, it really hits differently for me because I listened through every one of those testimonies in court as these brave women got up and told their stories during the sentencing part, because Larry Nassar pleaded guilty. And it was gut-wrenching to listen to. And so, yeah, I mean, $139 million doesn't really do justice, but hopefully the FBI has become a better organization going forward.
Yeah, it's good to see those women getting some kind of justice, even if it's not enough justice. Mm-hmm. But... yeah. That is all the time we have today for the news. We are going to switch over to the mailbag.
Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Okay, last week during our last deep dive, which was on young people's smartphone and social media use, I talked about this conversation I had with LeVar Burton, who told me that parents who
so
want their
jealous,
kids
by
to
the way.
Read... Look, you should be. You should be. It was great. It was great. but he told me that parents and other adults in kids' lives who want to see those kids reading more, especially when it comes to physical books, should model that behavior of showing, letting them see you read physical books instead of you also being on your phone all the time. And we got this.
Hello, my name is Dan from Boulder, Colorado. And that's one of the reasons we have maintained a subscription to our paper newspaper, especially when the kids were in elementary school. Having them watch us page through the newspaper was great. And in addition, they could use the paper themselves, either to check the weather, which happened occasionally, or, more commonly, to read the comics. Every day, they enjoyed pulling open that section of the paper and reading with us. It's not evidence-based, but it worked for us.
Oh, I love that. That's so sweet. Yeah, what a nice little ritual to have as well.
I have questions, like, what about making paper airplanes?
Out of newspaper? Really good use. It's too flimsy.
It's a little flimsy, but you could do it. You could do it. I guess
you did quite a few folds.
I got pretty good at this. Yeah, you a few folds. I've done it back in the day. It's fun.
Okay.
All right, one more. Last week we talked about the Australian animated kids show Bluey, which I just watched a little bit before we got going here. It is beloved by kids and parents alike, and we got this.
Hi, Make Me Smart team. This is David from Jacksonville, Florida, calling from a house full of Bluey fans. If anyone is interested in checking out the show, I would recommend to the Marketplace audience to begin with Season 1, Episode 20, Markets. In a 7-minute cartoon about talking dogs visiting a farmer's market, there are illustrations about inflation via the Tooth Fairy, opportunity cost, and how money flows through an economy. I really do recommend checking it out, even if you don't have young kids. Thanks for making us smart.
I'll have to go and look for that one. I didn't know that they dealt with that.
I was looking at that very episode. Yeah, and my favorite part is the dog with the cowboy hat. But that's
I'll have to watch it so I can get the reference. But we want to hear more from Bluey fans. What's been the best episode you've watched that you think kids and grown-ups would enjoy? Or the one that you revisit from time to time? Send us your top picks. Maybe we can put it in the newsletter or something. But before we go, we're going to leave you with this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something you thought you knew that but later found out you were wrong about?
This is Tamara in Colorado. Being a longtime marketplace listener, I thought I had a really good understanding of trade deficits. I am currently taking a finance and accounting class and very recently learned the historical context behind why the inversion from the World War II era to the 70s, when we started importing more goods than we exported, was drastically different. This historical context was not something that I had ever learned. So I thought I knew about trade deficits, and I was happy to say that there was more information there than I had at my fingertips.
Wow. I didn't know that either.
I'm stumped. I didn't know about this. And
yeah.
I'm going to go look that up. This inversion thing. Yeah.
You know, there's been so many shifts in the economy. And Justin Ho's been doing some reporting on this for us about sort of how many of these sort of standard practices of the way that we think the economy works actually still apply anymore and which ones are different. And, you know, I feel like World War II was another one of those great global economic resets where they kind of just had to revisit a lot of the models and make some new ones. But that is exactly what the Make Me Smart question is for. What's something you thought you knew, but later found out you were wrong about?
Question.
We want to hear your answer to the Make Me Smart question. You can let us know what you've discovered, and we can all get smarter together. So leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UBSMART. Make Me Smart is produced by Courtney Bergseeker. Ellen Rolfes writes our newsletter. Today's program was engineered by Juan Carlos Torrado, with mixing by Jay Siebold. And our intern is Talia Menchaca.
Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Our senior producer is Marissa Cabrera. Bridget Bodner is the director of podcasts. Francesca Levy is the executive director of digital. And Marketplace's vice president and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
Guess I gotta go watch some Bluey.
Yeah, me too.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.